You are listening to episode 18 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order, a show that talks about technical and geeky stuff, centering upon and concentrating on GNU and Linux and Unix and things like that. Got a mixed bag today, but a lot of it's going to have to do with Raspberry Pi, so let's get started. But of course, before we start talking about the Raspberry Pi, we have to talk about listener feedback. So the first listener feedback I can think of off the top of my head, although I swore at the time I'd forget it, but I haven't, is from Mr. Jackson, or Mr. Work, or Mr. Tablet, however you might know him. But he spoke to me on IRC about the default QR code scanner on, I guess, most Android, or maybe all Android phones. I don't really know, but he says that they do ask by default what you want to do with what you've just scanned. So it's not like you scan the QR code and are whisked immediately off to some site unknown. You're asked if you want to go there or download something or whatever. I haven't seen the screen and I kind of forgot to ask him, like, what does it do? Does it just say, keep going to a site? Or does it actually tell you what site it is so that you can at least look at the link and see if you really do want to go there? Or if it just warns you if you're about to download something, you know, what exactly the feedback is. But the point is that it sounds like on Android you do get feedback. You get a little bit of you get the opportunity to intervene after you scan something. And that seems like an important and really a good thing. Let's see, I got some other feedback from Dan Fry, who you probably know from Tilts, the Linux Link Tech Show. But Dan was emailing me about something called multi-system, is what it's called. You can find it over at liveusb.info/.clear, but the whole site is in French. But you can get other instructions for reference over at pindrive.linux.com/multiboot-create-a-multiboot-usb-from-linux. So if you go over there and read the instructions on how to do this with Ubuntu, then you can, I'm sure, translate it to lots of other distributions. Point being that on a singular 16 gigabyte USB stick that he got for like $13.99 from Amazon, he's got Ubuntu 12.04, 64-bit, Linux Mint 13, 64-bit, Mithubuntu 12.04, 64-bit and 32-bit, System Rescue CD, Fedora 17, DBAN, Parted Magic, and he says there's plenty of room for more than that, which I'm not surprised. All of those are probably just CD images, so it's less than a gig for each distribution. So the point is that you can have one USB drive with a whole bunch of Linux distributions that you can then choose which one to go into, which, I mean, obviously we've all known that you can do that sort of thing before. I mean, for many reasons. I mean, probably many of us have a USB thumb drive with Linux OS on it as a bootable thing. And I'm sure we've all seen magazine DVDs and things like that that come with like five different distributions on them, and they come up with a menu and you can choose which one you want to boot into. So it's obviously something that's been possible for a while. This makes it really easy, and it's really cool, obviously, to have lots and lots of Linuxes on something that you can carry around in your pocket. And I really like this for a number of reasons, actually. One of them is because there would be a lot of times where I would go somewhere, or I'd be somewhere, and about 50% of the time I would, well, almost like 90% of the time, because again, I'm the computer guy among the people that I hang out with. So about 90% of the time, there would be some reason that I would suddenly think, gee, wouldn't it be great to have a live Linux CD, a Linux live CD right now at this moment? 50% of the time I did, because I used to keep them pretty much in my backpack just because they were convenient. That's where I kept them. There was always one there. The other 50% of that 90% of the time, I would be without, and I would be so angry. You know, I'd just be like, why didn't I, you know, I always have a live CD with me. Why don't I have that? So the great thing about having a live boot, multi-system boot USB thumb drive is, I mean, really, thumb drives are a dime a dozen, as we all know. I mean, you can get them for free at a lot of the technical conventions. You just, you get them for all manner of reasons. You inherit these things. You find them, you purchase them for cheap, whatever. They don't even have to be fancy. They don't have to be large. 2 gigabyte thumb drive at one point was, at this point is kind of small. You know, what are you going to do with 2 gigs? Well, you'd have 2 Linux distributions on there, so not that bad. So you can have a thumb drive. You can put it in a backpack or put it in your pocket, whatever, on your keychain, wherever you keep these things. And you do. You've got Linux on you at all times. That's the obvious reason to really like this concept of having multiple distributions on your thumb drive, especially things like what Dan was saying, System Rescue, CD, D-Band, Parted Magic. I mean, those things, I mean, those are great to have on you. You know, if you're a techie person, you need those tools, and you can put Fedora onto a thumb drive, but then you're not going to get a lot of those sort of techie basic tools. I mean, the more and more these distributions start leaning towards quote-unquote desktop Linux, they start stripping out, like, really, really common things. I mean, I can't tell you how annoyed I am when I install a new distribution on a computer or in a virtual machine, and I go to do something very simple, like fire up Vim, and Vim isn't there. And I'm like, okay, well, Vi will be there. So I type in Vi, and it's not even there. You know, I mean, that boggles my mind. Just little things that basic. I mean, don't even get me started on not including Emacs. Come on, that should be everywhere. But yeah, you know, I mean, it gets frustrating. Much less are they going to have things like Gparted. But the other reason I like it lately is because a lot of people, and by a lot I mean 2, maybe 3, have been asking me about dual booting with 2 different Linux distributions. Well, actually, no, one of them was dual booting Linux and Windows. The other 2 have been 2 Linux distributions. And I'm always hesitant, I think with good reason, to suggest dual booting really as an option, as a practical option. That's a little bit hypocritical of me, because when I was first starting, I was dual booting Slackware and like Ubuntu. Ubuntu to get the work done that I needed to get done by a certain deadline, and Slackware to learn Linux on and have fun and kind of hack away on stuff, if you can call stumbling through a complex Linux system hacking. I guess you can. But anyway, point is, it's a little bit hypocritical because I did dual boot, but now, and maybe this is just a product of me having used Linux for quite some time now, but I hesitate to recommend for people to dual boot, unless it's just really, really important for them to do so. And the reason I hesitate to do that is because I know how complex and needlessly complex dual booting can be. My one friend who wanted to dual boot Windows with Linux ended up, of course, erasing his Linux partition. I was not involved in that at all. He asked me the questions after he'd already done that, so I take absolutely zero blame for it. Although, you know, in a sense, it's kind of a triumph, not really. Not a bad thing. Actually, it was a bad thing because he hadn't backed up anything. So it was really, really bad. And this is kind of the thing. You know, dual booting, if you don't know what you're doing, dual booting is really, really dangerous. It's complex. It can also kind of a little bit taint your Linux experience. And by that, I mean, Linux is a very open-ended thing. And everyone knows that. Everyone knows that anything is possible, or everyone looking into Linux knows that anything is possible. The weird thing for a new Linux user is to jump in and just think, okay, great, I can do anything now, not really realizing that they don't know how to do anything, much less how to do anything. So they go onto forums and websites and stuff, and they read about all this cool stuff, like dual booting and installing lots and lots of different desktop environments and what else? The RM command. You know, things that we as Linux users just bandy about carelessly because they're so normal to us. And we don't really realize that a lot of these really basic things only come after you've used Linux and you understand for the first time what a partition really is, and you understand how final the rm command really is, and all these other things that we just kind of talk about like it's not a big deal. So I think dual booting is right up there with a lot of the other things that I don't really love to tell people to do, because it taints, it doesn't ruin by any means, but it taints their Linux experience, I think, because they're already getting over this hurdle of, okay, I have this pre-built operating system that I used to use, so come on, Linux, impress me. And even though they think that Linux is going to impress them by saying you can do anything you want, really what they're looking for at that very initial stage, at least in my experience, is, hey, look at how packaged I am. Look how pre-built I am for you. I have everything you need. It's all so smooth and integrated. Let's get into the experimentation a little bit later. So, dual booting, I think, is overrated. I tend to discourage it now myself. And I think that live thumb drives is a great way to get the same thrill of dual booting without having to dual boot. And by this, I mean simply that you can take a really nice thumb drive install of a very reliable Linux OS. You could use it as your, okay, I need to get some serious work done while Slackware or whatever is actually on my hard drive. I'll just plug in this thumb drive, boot into it, get my school paper done, save the school paper to another thumb drive, a data drive, and hey, you've got you could do the whole persistent storage thing. I was burned by that once. I haven't really looked at it again. But you can do that. You can have the dual booting experience without actually having to dual boot. Or similarly, if you're just a distro hopper, which, as I've said before, I kind of discourage myself, although, again, it's hypocritical, because if you don't try different distributions, how will you ever know which one is right for you? You can do that, though. You can distro hop all you want. And you don't have to sit there and manage, you know, try to figure out, okay, now where do I want this bootloader to get installed? Does it need to be in the MBR, or should I just put it over here on its own little partition, the root part of this partition? And then if I do that, how do I get to that partition? It gets very complex for new users, especially if you've got like this persistent kind of Linux distribution that you use normally on partition one, and then you keep swapping out distributions on the second one, or if you just keep wiping your hard drive and installing a single boot system, but you're just doing lots of distro hopping and keep importing your data, it gets time consuming, it gets silly. The thumb drive thing seems really logical to me. So, excited again about thumb drive Linux. Thanks for all the feedback, everyone, and now we'll talk about Southeast Linux Fest. I recently attended Southeast Linux Fest, about 2 weeks ago now, and I have to say that it succeeded to meet all possible expectations. It was a fantastic event, really, really came together nicely. The new organizer, maintainer, whatever he is, the person in charge of it all, making it all happen, Jeremy Sands, incredible person. I don't know how he does it. Not that Dave Yates didn't do it well. He did Southeast Linux Fest fantastically for 3 years. And Jeremy Sands took over just this year, I think. And he has been a really good organizer on the mailing list anyway. Like last year, and probably even the year before, I don't remember exactly, but certainly last year, I remember dealing with Jeremy Sands a lot about the program guide. And you could tell the guy has the whole organizational thing down. You know, he's a good project manager, I guess is what you'd call him, or this position. But as taking all of that management skill and applying it to the rest of the festival, rather than just speaker coordination or whatever he was doing last year, was really, really, I wasn't sure how it would scale, but it really, really worked well. And Jeremy Sands has this ability really to always appear completely calm and aware of everything. And I don't know how he does that. And it impresses me, you know. I mean, I'm not a terrible manager myself. I can produce things fairly well and manage lots of different things. But the way Jeremy manages to do all of that and also be able to completely face you and look you in the eye and interact and talk to you like you actually have his attention, which I guess you do, although he always has something going on in his ear, you know, the walkie that he's using. So it's just, I don't know how the guy does it, but the festival's just gotten really, really nice. It's gotten big, it's gotten better, really, and as I've said before, bigger and better don't necessarily, to me, mean a good thing. You know, getting bigger and having more tracks and all this other stuff, that doesn't always translate to me to being a better event. But in this case, at least this year, it really came off really nicely. I felt like there was a really good variety of talks to go see. There was a good crowd. It was a good space. It was just, it was a huge success. If you have not been, I urge you again to attempt to go. The cool thing this year was that you also, or one also, got to meet the entire cast of Colonel Panic, Ogcast. That was pretty incredible. I never thought that would ever, ever happen. It would have been nice if some of the older core members were there, you know, from the old Linux Cranks days, but if you think of Colonel Panic, Ogcast proper, then most of the key personnel were there, although, I mean, I guess in these kinds of shows, the cast is so vast, you'll never really have everyone there, but it was pretty incredible to have Delwyn, I think from Florida maybe, Peter64 and his family from Australia, and then everyone else that you kind of know from the show. Oh, Azimuth from, I don't know where he lives, but Montana or something, or someplace like that, I don't know. But, I mean, lots and lots of far-off places. It wasn't just the four or five people who happened to live up and down the east coast of the U.S., you know. It was all over the place. Really, really neat to see everyone there. I kept feeling, wow, we really should be doing something to commemorate this. We should do a show. We should do something, a panel, something. But it didn't happen, and I don't think it could have happened. People were too busy socializing and having fun, which, honestly, there's a huge part of, I think, these technical conventions that is just the people hanging out and having fun, especially at a certain stage in your Linux usage. I think you go through different stages, and early in your Linux usage, you need all that information. You need to hear all of these terms, and you need to see people typing commands in. You need to get a feel for what's possible. You need all that stuff, so you go to every talk. You don't understand anything, but you sit there, and you listen, and you watch, and you learn. And then sort of maybe in the intermediate stage, and probably, strangely, the advanced stage, you start looking for specific talks, you know, the different set of talks. But if you're an intermediate person, you might be looking to see what another desktop has to offer you, or seeing how exactly you do set up that shared server that you've been meaning to set up. So you look for these specific talks, and then during all the other talks that you don't care so much about, you're socializing again. And if you're the advanced Linux user, two things will happen. You're either giving talks, or you're advanced enough that you don't have to go to talks, or or you're finding the really, really advanced talks that you need to know about. So, again, there's a lot of time there for socializing. I think the people who are busiest at these things are either the people putting the show on, like Jeremy Sands and Jace and Kevin and all these people who are making the event happen, or you are a noob who needs to know all this information, and you need to just go around and talk to people and listen to talks and just kind of absorb it all. And everyone else, I think, is just kind of there half for the tech and half for the, look at me, I get to hang around other computer people. So, a lot of fun no matter where you are in your Linux life, and definitely worth going to. It really is. I would say that if you want an experience, you know, the technical convention experience, Southeast Linux Fest it might be the one to go to. There are obviously a lot of other ones around, and you can go to those, and I haven't been to them all, so me suggesting Southeast Linux Fest is a little bit biased, because that's just kind of the one that that I've been there since the beginning now. You know, I've been to every single one. I've been the program guide, graphic layout person for every single show. I've been a volunteer. You know, I've been there. I feel kind of like, I don't know, a little bit of a part of that show. So there's that personal investment that I've made into it that certainly drives me to recommend it. But there are a lot of different shows, and there are a lot of different types of shows. And of course, everyone kind of knows, or maybe has heard about the trade shows, you know, the proper trade shows that people literally get sent to because their boss wants them to go out and learn about something or investigate an upcoming purchase. And those are the ones that aren't really fun because people aren't there to socialize at all. They're there because they have to be there. They get their little checks in the boxes that they need to get, and then they go back to their hotel room and sleep, or they go to the bar and drink or whatever. Whereas Southeast Linux Fest, people are there for other people, so it's a very different feeling from another technical convention that you might be close to, unless you're close to a Linux Fest or a Linux Expo, something that is put on more by a community rather than by some big company that needs to attract vendors and sell things and stuff like that. But it's a great show. Whatever your reasons for going, whatever you want to get out of it, you can get out of it. You can meet people. You can socialize with people. It's a lot of fun. And you learn a lot, too. Again, whether or not you are going to talks, you're going to learn something if you talk to people. And it's pretty cool. At these events, I think, you know, it's kind of, and this is probably a lot broader than I realize. This probably bleeds out into normal life as well. But at this event, for instance, I was standing around one evening at the hotel lounge where they were having sort of the after party or whatever. And some guy who I'd kind of seen at the KDE booth, he just kind of came up to me and started talking to me. And it was funny because I almost felt like we were both aware of the fact that we were forcing a conversation upon ourselves. Like, there was this very intentional, okay, we're going to talk until we find some common ground and common interest, and then we're going to hold a conversation. And it you'd think that KDE would be the entry point, and I think it was, if I recall correctly. Actually, no, it wasn't. It was vegetarianism. But, you know, whatever the case may be, you start talking, and then you just kind of hammer it out until you find enough stuff to hold a mutual conversation. And it worked. It was really funny. And I'm sure that's how parties are in real life, too. Like, if you go to a party, I'm sure that's what you're supposed to do. Like, just go up to people and start talking. And if both people are playing the same game, and many times you are, because otherwise why are you at a party, you just hammer out a conversation. You make it work. You're like, I don't know what we're going to talk about. I don't know why we're going to talk about it. But let's just keep talking until we both latch onto a subject and can talk ourselves into a conversation. And if that doesn't happen, then okay, nothing, no harm done. You've had a distraction, you've met someone, whatever. But if it works, then hey, you've had a great conversation. Maybe you've made a new friend, whatever. So it was interesting. It was like an interesting social interaction. And that's what these conventions are to a degree. If you don't know people, or if you find yourself in a talk or at a party where you don't know a whole lot of people, you can find stuff to talk about, and you do interact with people a lot more naturally than you might expect yourself if you're the type who doesn't really interact with people all that well from just ground zero. You know, just from 0 to 60 takes you a while to get from not knowing anyone to knowing someone. At a Linux convention, you pretty much know that you have some easy entry points there. You've got Linux, you've got computer talk, you know, you've got stuff you can talk about. And that's what people are there for. So it's kind of a cheat. It's a social interaction hack. Get together with other computer people, other Linux people, and talk about Linux. It's like free socializing. It's a stress-free socializing practice. So check it out if you haven't been. It's really fun. Southeast Linux Fest has that benefit, at least in my mind, of having two really, really great communities that just seem to have latched on to Southeast Linux Fest. There's the Red Hat slash Fedora crew, because obviously Red Hat is located in the Carolinas, and Southeast Linux Fest is located in the Carolinas, and I'm saying the Carolinas because I can never get them, I never know where I really am. I think this year it was North Carolina and Charlotte. I don't know where Raleigh or whatever, wherever Red Hat is. I don't know if that's in South or North. Either way, it's the Carolinas. They're there. They come to the festival. So if you're interested in it all, Red Hat or Fedora, that's a great conference to go to because they're all over the place. There's a really strong representation of sort of that community and that kind of sensibility, you know, that Red Hat sensibility. And I mean that in a good way in this case. So there's that. And then there's the Slackware community, which, as I understand, just because a lot of the Slackware people are in the South, I guess this was the convention that was easy for them to get to. And so they show up in droves. And by droves, I mean 6 or 7 people. It's huge. It's enormous. It's crazy. It's out of control. So go there, meet all these people, be around smart people, talk to them, or hear them talk. You learn so much. It's not even funny. This year I also had a video camera and some lights that I set up, and I started interviewing people at the Hacker Public Radio booth just for fun. I feel like I didn't get as many interviews as I would have liked. I feel like I would have liked to get more, and then I could cut them together into like a little interview collage thing, which I might still do. I just don't feel like I'm going to have quite as many interviews in the collage as I would have liked. I might also, if that doesn't work out, I might just release just the audio. So one of those two things will happen eventually, soonish, and that was good. It was nice to talk to people, interview people, just find more out about people. I would have loved to get more interviews, really, but I think for interviews, video, you really need to have a camera person following you around, and you just have to be really aggressive. So the camera was actually kind of weighing me down in that sense, because I didn't have a camera person, and I wasn't going to just carry it around in my hand pointing it at me, at myself. So that kind of weighed me down. I think probably I would have been better off without the camera and lights and just grabbed my audio recorder and, again, just be really aggressive and get people to be interviewed by me. So that's worth noting for anyone who wants to go do interviews. The Hacker Public Radio booth came out really well. It's got a nice, beautiful sign provided by David Whitman, a Hacker Public Radio community member. I say community member like everyone isn't a community member. So a Hacker Public Radio person. So he hooked us up with a nice tall banner sign thing that was designed, of course, by Richard Quarin. So yeah, that looked great. We had a lot of people coming around. Having lights and a camera set up probably didn't actually hurt, so that was kind of nice just for show, to be honest. And I was also selling the hard copy of my book, Slacker Media. I was trying to sell it for a cup of coffee. I had like 11 copies, and so I figured if I sell each one for a coffee, then I'd have 11 free cups of coffee that day. Unfortunately, no one wanted to do that. No one wanted to pay me in coffee. I don't know why. I thought that sounded like a pretty good trade to me. But some people bought it for money. I took a loss. Don't worry, I haven't turned into a vendor. But some people bought it for money. Some people stole it, which is good. And some people, one person got me 2 cups of coffee for one book. So, I don't know. All in all, I saw that as a successful business venture. And I should probably thank 330 for helping me sell the book. He's a really good marketing person. 330 is like a brilliant marketing mind, and he really assisted me on that. If you want to get your own copy, eventually it's going to show up on Amazon or Barnes and Noble. You can also just download it for free, of course, as I've said before, at slackermedia.info. And I'm not making any money off of it. It's just a purely, well, it's vanity and convenience. Vanity because I just like to see something that I wrote in book form, in hard cover, or not hard cover, but, you know, hard paper, hard copy form. It's just kind of neat. And then convenience, because a lot of times, I have to admit, it is nice to just have the book, you know, rather than an ebook file that you're reading on one computer while you're working on another computer, or however you would manage it. It can be nice to have the hard copy. So it's not. I'm not making any money off of it. I knocked the price down as far down as they would allow me to go. So someone's, I think, making like 10 cents per copy, but it ain't me. So if you want to buy one, feel free to do so. If not, feel free to go grab the plain text or the EPUB copy of it or the HTML copy of it over on slackermedia.info. One more thing before we get onto the Raspberry Pi, and that is the directory.fsf.org. Directory.fsf.org, if you have not been there, is essentially, I want to almost say a wiki. I mean, it is technically on the back end, like a wiki of some sort, I think. But maybe more significantly, it is a package listing of a bunch of free software stuff. It's not GNU only, so it's really just, and it's not even only GPL stuff, so even though it's on the FSF site, it has a lot of different stuff listed on it, and it's a great resource, I think. As you know, if you've heard anything I've done lately or at all, then you know that I'm a huge fan of this kind of thing, because I really honestly think that it's a service, because everyone, as I've said before, everyone that I've ever met, the paradigm for them finding new software is to poke around online and look at the site and download an installer from the internet, and that's just kind of how we find new stuff. And that's fine, I think. That's totally fine. I just happen to think it's really smart to have all of the good free stuff aggregated somewhere. You don't know how to search for KDE or for GNOME or Enlightenment or anything if you don't even know that such a thing exists. And this is why, one reason why I like PBIDIR.com so much, which is from the PCBSD people. PBIDIR, as I've mentioned when I was reviewing PCBSD at some point, it's really nice. It's actually quite beautiful site. If you go there, pbidir.com, it just lists all the different categories that you would kind of think of as a computer user, whether you're a geek or not, and some that you wouldn't think of, for instance, like I say, like desktop environments and things like that. I mean, you probably wouldn't really, if you don't know such a thing exists, you're not going to be looking for it, but that's the point. That if you go to this place, if you go to pbidir.com, then you get to see all of these cool software categories and things that you just didn't even know existed, and you can really explore free software. And I think that's very, very powerful, because if you're searching on the internet search thing for, I don't know, an audio editor, let's say. Let's just be really simple. Obviously, you're going to come up with Audacity. That's the one free audio editor you'll find, and then you'll find a whole bunch of hits for all of these other proprietary solutions. And you might default to Audacity anyway, because that's a pretty ubiquitous project. Everyone seems to know about it. It's a really great little program. But let's say that it wasn't an audio editor, it's something else. You might truly, truly get a little bit overwhelmed. Whereas if you've got something that only lists free software solutions, I think that's really powerful. So directory.fsf.org is sort of that. I mean, it is that, really. It's a little site or a little portion of the FSF site, and you can browse about almost 7,000 software projects. It's not quite as pretty as the pbidir.com. It doesn't have fancy icons next to all the categories, and it doesn't have icons on the page listing of the actual software that you're looking at. But that's not that big of a deal, because it's still really great information, and it's got a lot of information. It lists different kinds of applications. It lists the details about the application, for instance, the licensing policy, how to get help, you know, where their IRC channel is, where their official homepage is, just all this other kinds of stuff. And of course, you can search it. So if you're searching for something very, very specific, you can type in a search thing for that. You get video converters, video arcades, video editors, you know, lots of different video effects, just all any, you know, it's just a keyword search. And it's great. It's really a cool little site, directory.fsf.org. I kind of got interested in this because I had noticed it, but probably about last year, middle of last year, that the FSF site was kind of not very active. It didn't look like there was a lot of activity there. It didn't feel alive, and that's something interesting about the internet. If you go to a site and the last update was a year ago, you just automatically think, well, this is a project on its way out. This is dying. And that goes for anything. It goes for a band's website, it goes for a software project's website, a company's blog, official blog, you know, whatever. I mean, if there's not life on that site frequently, you assume, I think, that it's not really happening. There's not much going on with that thing. I think that's probably totally erroneous. I mean, it's probably correct sometimes, but I think a lot of times it's erroneous. I mean, a lot of times you have something to put online and you place it there and you just don't have to go back and change it. And there's not really a need for a blog or a microblog or anything like that. And I think it's a weird thing that we have, and I think it's kind of a little bit maybe hurtful to the web at large, because then you have people doing silly things like piping all their friends' Twitter messages to a sidebar on their site, you know, because, hey, look, there's activity on this page. Has nothing to do with me. I'm just aggregating some random stuff from the internet, but there's life. It's kind of silly. Be that as it may, I noticed that the FSF site didn't seem like a very go-to place for anything about free software. Just why would you go there except to read one or two paragraphs about what the FSF is and how important free software is? There's just no reason to go there. Well, directory.fsf.org, I feel, is a big step in the right direction, where it becomes a hub of information about free software, about stuff that you can run on your computer that is not proprietary. So, directory.fsf.org, I guess it's technically been around for a while, but it's recently gotten a lot better. It's been improved. The back end, the way that you interact with the data, all that stuff, a lot more friendly. It looks nicer. And the cool thing is that it is like a wiki, it's a wiki of some sort. I went to a meeting in #FSF on irc.freenode.net and have been put in like a, not an admin, but like someone who can add and look at bug reports on entries and things like that. So I've been contributing that way myself. I don't know, I hadn't contributed before, so I don't know what you can do without doing that. Maybe you can't. Maybe you just go into FSF and ask, hey, put me on your admin list so I can start adding and editing entries for different software projects. But feel free to do that, is my point. Feel free to go to FSF, offer your assistance, and in your idle time at work or whatever, you too could enter and update free software projects little pages on FSF.org. And like I say, it's not just GPL stuff. It's a lot of different stuff. You know, they list Firefox and things that are not in that are not covered by the GPL, by some other license. So it's a valuable surface, I think. It's something that you should take a look at and try to contribute to if you feel like that's something that you'd want to contribute to. I think it's a nice, easy way to just kill a little bit of time. Like maybe when you want to just kind of, I don't know, you're watching a movie or something and you're thinking, well, I should really be doing something else other than just watching a movie, so I'll just update this entry for KDE or add this entry for Git or whatever. So it's one of those little mindless projects that you could contribute to if you're looking for something like that. So check that out. It's directory.fsf.org. You know what that music means? It means it's time for a cup of coffee, so go get yourself one. I'm having a coffee that apparently comes from Costa Rica. I don't know. That's what the package said. It tastes really, really good. It's smooth but rugged. Makes no sense, but it's a good one. So find something very, very good and have it. And we'll get back to the show. I was going to make an obligatory joke about having coffee with a nice slice of raspberry pie, but it's so bad I just couldn't even pull it off. Raspberry pie, unless you've been living under a rock, you'll have heard of. It is the tiny little circuit board with an ARM chip, an Ethernet port, USB, and HD video output. This is a really, really exciting project, and yet it's not. And I'll explain that to you. So it's an exciting project because it is really, really low wattage computing made possible. This to me is hugely exciting because lately I've noticed about myself that there are two types of computing for me, and this might be different depending on who you are, but I'm just talking for me, and you can sort of think about your own feelings on this, and I don't know, do an art project later to express those feelings, whatever you want. But for me, there are two types of computing. There's the normal kind of computing where all I need is something with a monitor and a keyboard and a processor preferably and Emacs, and I'm done. That's all I need. Basically, it's an electronic typewriter, except, you know, with the convenience of a computer. And for that, I have found that I don't need much power at all, right? You just don't need much to do that. And that's literally, that's probably, I don't know, 60% of my computing time, is maybe possibly more, is spent on that kind of activity, just writing or you know, normal computer activities, maybe lightweight web browsing, although honestly not really. So yeah, that's one type of computer. The other type of computer is the polar opposite, where I need a whole bunch of gigaflops and terawatts and things like that, where I need numbers to be crunched in massive quantities, and I don't even want to know that they're numbers, so I want pretty graphics on the screen, because I'm doing, you guessed it, video editing, or I'm doing compositing, or 3D, not 3D effects, but motion graphics. That's the other kind of computer that I need. And that's probably 40%, possibly 30% of my actual computing time. Because, unless if I'm embarking on some kind of huge project where I need, where I'm spending all day doing something very heavy and very intensive. But that's not where I am right now, and it hasn't been where I am in a while. I've not needed that kind of thing for, well, actually, about 8 months ago I was there. But, you know, that's a kind of intermittent thing. You don't do that all day, every day, unless you work as an editor, which is your only job, but that's not what I do. I do lots of different things. Sometimes I'm editing, and it will be an all-day thing, and it will be an all-day thing for 2 or 3 weeks, but then it's over again. And that's kind of the nature of my business. You know, it's like plan, everything happens in a really compressed time, and then you're done. And that's, and then you're looking for the next project. That's just how that works. So for me, most of my computing time is spent on computers that can be very, very low powered. Now, that is not how it has always been for me, and that's caused me a little bit of confusion, because for a very long time, I didn't have a place for a desktop. I didn't have a place where I could put a very all-powerful computer. And so I needed my laptop that I took around with me on an everyday basis to be powerful enough to do all that video stuff when it needs to do that video stuff. But, you know, again, 60-70% of the time, all it's doing is that low, simple, electric typewriter type of activities. And that's a really weird combination to have, you know. Okay, I want a really basic computer, but sometimes I'm going to need it to be super powerful. So you have to buy and lug around the super powerful one, even though you're only using it as an electric typewriter most of the time. So lately I've been realizing that I do have my desktop now. I've got the super powerful computer that I can use when I need it to be powerful. And for everything else, all I really want is something that turns on reliably and lasts all day. I don't want to have to worry about power. I don't want to have to go to some random cafe and have to turn around and leave because they don't have accessible plug electric outlets, leads in the wall. That's not fun. It's very inconvenient. So, I'm realizing low-power computing is very important for, I think, again, 60 or 70% of the computing tasks. It's really, really nice to have something that just takes a couple of watts. Speaking of that, we're back at the Raspberry Pi. The Raspberry Pi is literally powered by USB. You plug a little micro USB cable into the thing labeled power on the circuit board, and you plug that USB, the other end of that micro USB cable, into something that provides power over USB. So your computer, one of those wall chargers, you know, that's like plugs into the wall, but then it's got a USB out on it. That's what I'm using right now. So you've got different options on how you want to power it in terms of what you're going to plug it into, but it's USB powered. And if you know anything about USB, you know that it doesn't provide a whole lot of wattage. I mean, I didn't look up to see how much it does provide, but people were doing tests online, and right now the number that I've been seeing is like an average wattage, like an average use of like 3 watts for the Raspberry Pi. That's nothing at all. If you get some kind of USB power pack, I imagine you could probably run the thing for a day, 2 days. You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. Very, very low power. That's really exciting to me. Now, I didn't know what that would mean in terms of the actual computing side of things. So I was very happy to get my Raspberry Pi in the mail about 4 days ago now. It shipped from the UK, so it took a little while, and of course there was a huge waiting list because they just have sold so many more units than they had expected, I think. But the thing is, what, $35 plus a little bit in shipping? I think it came out to a total of $42. So, really exciting, really cheap, really low power. So I plug the thing in, I grab a spare SD card, and decide to learn how to install Linux onto the thing. Turns out it's really, really simple. There are a couple of different outlets for this. You can go to raspberrypi.org/download, I think, and they have a Debian image there. You can go to Fedora Project something or another Raspberry Pi, and they've got nightly snapshots that supports the Raspberry Pi, although I did not have very good luck with it, because once it booted into X, which of course it wants to do, it crashed. So that wasn't all that great. But there's also, of course, an ARMed Slack version for this that Mr. Jackson told me about. This is something that someone just kind of came up with and posted to the Raspberry Pi forum. It's funny. You don't go to ARMed Slack for it. It's just in this forum posting. I mean, I'm sure it'll propagate somewhere. Eventually, I'll add the link to the website so you can go find this thing. But the actual install process is just embarrassingly simple. It's simply a matter of doing a dd. It's dd space if equals the ARMed Slack image. Of equals /dev/ whatever your memory card is, MMCBLK0, or whatever it would be. So it's just you literally DD the image over to the SD card. Now there's a cool trick online as well on how to resize the partition so that you're not just using the image itself, because the image might only be, I don't know, 2 gigs or something like that, whereas your SD card might be more like, I don't know, 8 gigs. So you have to resize those partitions and let yourself use the whole memory card. This is nice because now you're not doing any kind of squash.fs thing. You're actually writing back to the SD card. It's a system. It's a hard drive. You know, it's not one of those live CD image types of things where you're running off the image, and then if you want to save stuff to persistent memory, you have to make a separate file system somewhere else on that device and kind of load that as part of the OS and keep writing back to that. No, you're actually using, you know, you've got a file system that your OS exists on, your home directory is there, you can write data to it, and so on. So you can resize the partitions of the flash drive or the SD card rather, actually after you've installed your image. And again, the install of the image is simply DDing the image file over to the card. Now, after that, you have to move the partition. And there's a great page on this on elinux.org/rpi_resize_flash_partitions. I will kind of review what the steps were. And in terms of getting more experience with hard drive partitions and learning more about how they work and how flexible they really are, this is really amazing. It's really cool. You do it with parted, so you have installed the image onto the SD card, and then you fire up parted with the path to your memory card. So it might be parted /dev/mmc/blk0, or if your computer sees it as an SDD or something like that. It all depends on how you've got it mounted into your on your computer. But I did /dev/mmc/blk0. First command you do is unit CHS, and that sets the display units not to megabytes, not to gigabytes, but to cylinders and something else, or a certain type of cylinders. It's CYL for one and then CHS for another. I forget which is which. Doesn't really matter. Change it to CHS. You can follow along. And then you do print. So print tells you the exact size of that SD card. It tells you where the partitions start and where they end. And so you'd see things like partition 1 starts at cylinder 16, comma 0, comma 0, and it ends at 1215, comma 3, comma 31. The type is primary, and it's a FAT32. So that's that would obviously be like the MBR or whatever. You know, that's the beginning of the card where all the little information goes about how to boot and stuff like that. Partition 2 would be 1232, comma 0, comma 0, until maybe, and this will change depending on what image file you've actually installed on the card. But let's just say, again, I'm kind of using it from the page at elinux.org. It was different for me, but it's easier to use their example. So 26,671, comma 3, comma 31, primary ext4, obviously that's your main Linux partition, and then the third was swap. Now, I didn't have a swap partition on mine, and I don't think I did, but I made one. I could be wrong about that. Point being, you see the partitions. More importantly, you see where they start and where they end. So partition 1 being the boot partition, that's fine. You don't want to resize that or change that. But partition 2 being the root partition where your actual Linux system is, that ought to fill the card, right? If you've got an 8 gigabyte card, and the image that you've just installed is only 2 gigabytes, then your root partition is probably only taking up, you know, 1.8 gigs or something like that. So you'd want to expand that. But in order to expand partition 2, you need to move partition 3. And that's the cool part that I'd never really done before. I'd never moved partitions before. I've resized, but I've not picked one up and said, okay, you're going to the end of the drive. But you can do that, and it only requires a little bit of math. So what you do is you take the maximum cylinder count of your SD card. So when we did the print of how many cylinders were used and so on, you see that the disk at /dev/mmc/blk0, for instance, was 121,535,3,31 available cylinder unit things, but you can see that the swap partition ends at a mere 29,743,3,31. Obviously, you're not taking up very much of that space. In fact, you're taking up, what, maybe a quarter of it or so. So you want to maximize what you're doing. You want to move partition 3 so that it's right up to the end of that 121,535 available space. So you would take the maximum amount, 121,535, and you would minus from it, you would subtract from it the result of the end point of the third partition minus the start point, right? So the full size of the third partition. So in this case, it's 29,743 minus 26,688, which I don't really know what that would be off the top of my head, but we can just, let's estimate about 3,000, right? 3,000 cylinders. So if we take that 3,000 and minus it from the maximum available amount, 121,000, we would want the third partition to start at 118,000 or so cylinders. Obviously, you'd want to do the math a lot more exactly than what I'm doing right now. They tell you to minus one from that, just, I guess, so you don't accidentally try to write the partition over the maximum amount of space. So you might consider it 118 or 117,999, something like that. But you get the idea. So you're taking the sum total of what that partition is, and you're moving it so that it ends at the very last block or cylinder, whatever, of your SD card. And the way that you do that is you simply say move 3, so you move the third partition, move 3, 118,479,0,0. And that is moving the third partition to the start point, that is 118,479, so that the end of it then ends up at 121,534, or whatever it would be. Simple enough, right? And then you just, all you have to do is grow and expand the second partition. So in order to do that, you do RM space 2, which removes the second partition, which, you know, your brain just goes immediately into overdrive. You're like, I can't do that. That's my root partition. I can't just remove it. Well, yes, you can. Remember, you're only manipulating partition tables here. So then you can make a new part. So MK part space primary space 1232,0,0. And of course, the 1232 is where the second partition that we just deleted, that's where that started. So we removed it, and then we're re-establishing it. And then the end point would, of course, be 118,478, because remember, the third partition started at 118,479. So this one's going to end at 118,478,3,31. And that's it. So now you've just made a new partition, a second partition, that takes up, I don't know, 7.7 gigabytes instead of 1.8. Pretty cool, huh? Okay, so then you quit parted, it's got its new partition table exists now, but now you need to clean up what you've just done, and you need to resize the file system itself. And I think that we were talking about this a few episodes ago. We were resizing partitions. Am I just making this up? I might be making this up, but certainly I was at some point. No, I did talk about this. Point is, I did this recently, and it's totally safe and fun. So you do an E2FSCK, so you're doing a file system check, telling it specifically that, hey, this is an ext2/3/4 file system. So E2FSCK space dash F space slash dev slash whatever partition. So in my case, it was MMCBLK0P2 or something like that. On your computer, if you've got it plugged into some kind of USB adapter or something, you might see it more like /dev/sdb2 or sdd2, whatever. So you're doing an FSCK, a file system check, on that partition that we've just manipulated. Then you do a resize to FS. This is the file system resizing tool for ext2 and 3 and 4. So resize to FS space /dev/, again, in my case, MMCBLK0. P2, whatever it would be for you, and that simply takes, it looks at the partition boundaries, it looks at where the file system actually exists, and it says, oh, let's make those two things the same, and it makes the file system expand out without actually erasing any data. You haven't ruined your root partition, you haven't done anything. You've simply rewritten with parted the boundaries of your partition, and now with resize to FS, you're taking that file system that was written with DD to your SD card as a 1.8 gigabyte file system, and you're expanding it out to that full 7.7 gigs or whatever it is in your case. And that's it. You pop the SD card into the Raspberry Pi card reader on the bottom of the card, on the bottom of the board, and you've just installed Linux onto your Raspberry Pi. So then you plug the thing into your power source, whatever it is. I've got a wall adapter that came with like a cell phone, it looks like. A friend of mine found it on the street, not in the middle of the street, but like outside of an apartment, was in the trash or whatever, and they found it and brought it to me because they knew I liked electronic things. And turns out it's really, really useful because it's got a power outlet on one side and a USB out port on the other. So I plugged it into there, plugged that into the micro side into the Raspberry Pi, and the thing turns on. And next thing I know, I'm looking at the boot screen of a Linux system. Instead of a little Tux, there's a little Raspberry in the frame buffer at the top. Scrolls through, it finds, you know, I've got the Ethernet plugged in and the HDMI cable plugged in. So actually, I'm using HDMI to DVI adapter, just for the record. And booting it up, and it boots up just fine. And I think I installed Fluxbox, or maybe it was already there. I think XFCE was already there. So I got into a GUI pretty quickly, because I wanted to see what kind of performance this thing was going to provide me in that sense. The GUI felt very laggy. It felt very, you know, you could tell you were on a slow computer. It felt like you're on an old computer trying to run the latest, greatest desktop environment, if you consider XFCE the latest, greatest desktop environment, which I know a lot of people do. But, you know, when you would grab a window and move it from the upper corner to the bottom corner, and this is an HD monitor I'm using, 1920 by 1080 right now. So it's a nice size screen. It's a good resolution that I'm requesting. But when I move windows around, it doesn't just slide over with your mouse. It you feel like you're pulling it. But in outside of that kind of thing, it feels normal-ish. You know, it feels like an older computer, I guess. I'm trying to convey the speed and responsiveness of it. Now, Mr. Jackson, again, this is like Mr. Jackson's episode. Mr. Jackson in IRC told me that he got an SD card that has like 95 megabits per second in, you know, I/O. And it's actually a lot more responsive. So I've got one on order, which, of course, funny, $38 for the SD card that I'm getting. So do the math. The SD card, shipping not included, the SD card is literally more expensive than the computer itself. I don't know, I thought that was funny. But yeah, so you put the SD card in the board and you fire it up, and maybe if once I get the faster SD card, maybe it will be a faster sort of computer. I don't know yet, because I haven't experienced that. But in terms of like the expectation of the Raspberry Pi performance is that as a GUI desktop, it feels right now like a computer that's maybe, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, something like that. Maybe longer, like 12 years ago. But it feels fine at the same time. So I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. I'm saying don't expect magic to happen, at least not yet. I could be wrong. I could find that a faster SD card makes it completely, incredibly fast and responsive. But you know that you're on a low-power computer, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that's okay. Because like I say, I think most uses of this little ARM board are going to be specific to certain tasks. You know, I don't see it, at least for myself, and I imagine probably for a lot of other people, it's not a general purpose kind of thing. Although it could be, which is important to note. If you're conservative and you use the Raspberry Pi for certain tasks, and you're mindful of what you're installing, you know, you're not trying to run KDE or GNOME on it. You're just running XFCE or Fluxbox. I went to Fluxbox on mine. And you know, instead of firing up Ocular for your PDFs, you use XPDF, little things like that. I think it could be a completely fine all-purpose computer. The other part of all of this that kind of detracts from it being a general-purpose computer is that when you get it in the mail, it doesn't have a case. I mean, it's a board. It is a circuit board with some chips and things on it, and it just sits there on your desk, you know, and it's running, but you don't have it encased in anything, which feels a little bit weird. So I think in that sense, it's a project. It's a hobby project like the old days where you get something in from the back of a comic book ad and you put it together and then you program it to do little things. Well, the Raspberry Pi shocked me a little bit in how easy it was to get up and running, right? I mean, all I did was DD the image over, resize a partition, start the thing up, and it's done. It's finished. It's a full Linux computer. It was almost, and I say this a little bit ironically, but I mean, it was almost a disappointment, you know? It was like so easy. Compare that to, for instance, the Pogo plug, which I've been struggling with for about 6 months now, trying to flash it with something that will work, that won't break, and now it's kind of a little bit of a brick, not exactly, but the point being, you know, you get these devices and you have to hack around them so much that when a circuit board comes to you in the mail and it's just like, install whatever you want, do whatever you want, it's almost, you don't know what to do with yourself. You're like, but that wasn't a hack. All I did was, but I mean, why should it have to be a hack? That's the thing, right? That's part of the reason this is so exciting, is that you've got this thing that is as powerful as, I don't know, a mobile phone or something, because that's what mobile phones are using, right? Those little ARM chips and stuff. I mean, it's computing power in the palm of your hand with 2, 3, 5 watts of power, less than it takes you. You know, if you're turning on a light bulb in your office or your room, you're suddenly using more power than your computer is using. You know, I mean, it's mind-boggling how beautiful that concept is. And it doesn't stand in your way. It's an open-ish platform. I understand that the video thing, I think, has some blobs in it or something. And I'm not sure if the circuit board design yet has been open-sourced or not. I'm not really sure. Point being, it's a very unobtrusive piece of technology. And that's hugely, hugely important to me, because we're all saying that technology is important and, oh, it's going to improve quality of life, and we're in it for the good of everyone. This is, you know, technology. It's going to make us all healthy and happy and have to work less. And yet we have all these stupid pieces of technology that won't let us do whatever we want with them, right? You get a cell phone, you have to root your own phone. You get a tablet, you have to root it. Nowadays, you get a computer from a certain manufacturer and you practically have to root it just to get stuff that you want on the stupid computer. It's like this technology that was supposed to be so great is nothing but standing in our way. It's frustrating us. So here comes the Raspberry Pi, and it's just like, hey, I'm not going to stand in your way. You don't have to root me. You don't have to do anything. There's no authentication key that you have to put on my BIOS to make me work. It's just, you put whatever you want on there. And once you're in the box, once you're in Linux, you can just install stuff. I was using ARM Slack. I grabbed packages from Slack PKG. I can grab packages from slackbuilds.org if I want. You know, you can do whatever you want to do with this thing. It's really, really, really exciting, and I think it's really significant. It's low-powered computing. It's doing all the typical tasks that we would want to do on a fraction of the power usage. It's just a hugely, hugely significant development in computing, I think. For 60% of the computing that I do, this Raspberry Pi can do that. And I guess the foreseeable future for me is kind of cobbling together a portable kit for this Raspberry Pi. You know, some kind of case, some kind of monitor, some kind of power unit, like a USB battery power thing that, you know, that you might plug into like a media player or your phone to like recharge your battery on the go. You know, one of those things. I'm thinking that the Raspberry Pi and a case of some sort, and then a little monitor and a little keyboard. I could foresee myself having a modular netbook that I could use for a lot of my everyday computer usage. And I'm excited about that. I think that's really, really significant, because I'm tired of fighting with laptops over their batteries and over their graphic card drivers and their wireless card drivers and all this other stuff. And I guess that's one thing that my Raspberry Pi does not have, is a wireless card. At least I don't think it does. I didn't really check. But couple of things, you could cobble it together and make it into anything you want, is the really significant thing. And it's super easy. And I urge you, if you are into computers at all, you've got to get a Raspberry Pi. There's no excuse for not having one. You must have one. If you're looking at, you know, you're thinking, well, I've got that gadget lust now and I want something. Should I get a tablet, or should I get a new phone, or should I get a new laptop? Forget all that. It's a scam. They want you to get a tablet, they want you to get a phone, they want you to get a laptop, and I'm telling you right now, it's a scam. They're baiting you. They want you to get the stuff, and then they're not going to let you do what you want with it, and then they're going to obsolete it by next month. The Raspberry Pi doesn't care about that. A friend of mine was looking for phones. They were looking for an Android phone, and it started getting down to like, well, what version of Android does it have on it? Because it was kind of like this concern that if they get the phone now with, you know, whatever confection of Android on it, then next month another release of Android with some other better dessert title will come out, and so their old phone will now be obsolete because they can't be guaranteed that the new version of Android will load on their phone. In today's technological age, for people to be worrying about, gee, can I get the new version of the OS on my device, that's shameful. I mean, it's like horrible. We're way, way beyond that right now. And as proof, I submit to you the $35 circuit board known as the Raspberry Pi. Put whatever you want onto it, do whatever you want to do with it. It's available, it's cheap, it's just so easy. Honestly, I mean, I wish they could make this thing somewhere other than in China. That would be really cool if they could actually get themselves out of that factory system and actually produce these things. I'd pay more than $35 for it. I'm okay with that idea. I could pay more for this little device. But that's just me. Point is, the Raspberry Pi is really, really cool. It's a lot of fun. I've been having a blast with it. The ARM processor itself is exciting. It's RISC-based processing. I don't know what that means, but I know that RISC is a term I've heard with PowerPC, and I always liked the PowerPC. So hey, get into it. Get a Raspberry Pi. Hook yourself up with one. You will not be sorry. It's just the coolest little gadget around. Really. It really is. It's just really, really cool, and it's a step in the right direction, I think. So much different than these stupid tablets and phones and things like that that just have no clue what they're doing. They're just trying to make sales. The Raspberry Pi is there for hacking and for learning and for playing, and it's low power. It's incredible. Get one today. Well, get on the waiting list today. Okay, that's all the time we have in this episode. I've already gone 15 minutes over the usual hour-ish show. Or maybe that's half an hour over the usual 45-minute show. I'm not really sure what the usual time for a show is. Either way, we're out of time. So, thank you for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can find me on IRC at irc.freenode.net in the channel Ogcast Planet. Now, understand about me and IRC, I'm idle on IRC pretty much all the time. I just have this instance of IRSSI running on a server, so I'm always there, but I'm not always there. So if you message me or talk to me, if I'm not there, just be patient. I'll get back and I'll answer you. If you log off, there's no way for me to message you back. So I don't know. Sometimes that can be less effective. If you want to email me, it's klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also find me on Jabber, not klaatu, at jabber.org. And you can find me online at gnuworldorder.info. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Every man, woman, and child in America